John chapter 6. Sometime after this, Jesus crossed to the far shore of the Sea of Galilee, that is the Sea of Tiberias, and a great crowd of people followed him because they saw the signs he had performed by healing those who were ill. Then Jesus went up on a mountainside and sat down with his disciples. The Jewish Passover festival was near. Help us, O Lord. Give us concentration on a pleasantly warm morning. Give us concentration, Lord, on your word, because your word is what feeds our souls. For your name's sake, amen. I retitled the sermon this way, Bringing the Fullness of Christ into the Foulness of Life. I guess each of us will have had our own responses to the latest Islamic Terrorism Act this last week. And I guess for many of us, there are a whole set of negative feelings and reactions and thoughts that we will have. A sense of outrage, deep pain for those who've been injured and those who've been killed, that awful sense of young girls being targeted that seems particularly gruesome somehow. Just a whole range of things. That's what we've seen in the media, and I guess each of us will have felt. I hope as Christians, and if you're not a Christian, a caring humanitarian sort of person, you'll also have had a sense of wanting to try to do something, but not being quite sure what you could do. It does seem to me that is a humanitarian response that Christians should have, because we want to be loving and caring towards people, and people who are not Christians will have as well. But also a sort of sense of powerlessness. How can little me make any difference in this world? And if we see this latest thing, this latest Islamic terrorist act, as a kind of representative of so much that's wrong in our world, I mean, to call it mindless violence and to say that it's impossible to understand, as many of the media have done, seems to me stupid. It comes out of a particular worldview which is intent on destroying people of other worldviews. That's what's going on. There may be other causal factors happening, but that's what lies at the heart of it. What can we do? How can we do anything? Is anyone saying anything that's meaningful? Yes, there may be some things, but will we be saying all this again the next time it happens? And then I was brought again to this passage, because I had to preach on it, and realize here that we see Jesus' love and compassion in action, bringing real change, and bringing a change that promises an even better, perfect change in the future in what he does. And then I realized you could lay this alongside the miracle that he did earlier, the drinking miracle, if you like, where he changed the water into wine, where his disciples were just watching, and he got the servants to do the pouring with the water, but essentially it was his miracle. And realize there's almost like a little bit of a change, because this time they are so deeply involved in what's going on. And I started to realize that actually there's a kind of picture here of the great lavishness and fullness of God's love and his power to bring change into this awful, in many ways, this the foulness of life. Because it is foul when people target young girls in the name of God and blow themselves up in the hope of an eternity as a reward. I mean, there is a foulness about that. But actually, there's a foulness in my heart as well, because I'm selfish, and I'm cruel and mean towards people. So what can I do? And I started to see that in Jesus, there is a fullness that comes into the foulness and brings change. And so we look at John 6. I think it's the only miracle that's recorded in all four Gospels. It was clearly seen by the Gospel writers as a significant one. There's one or two kind of minor details about it, but they all include it for us. John includes a number of details you don't find in the other Gospels, and it has, in its own way, like the others do, the kind of ring of eyewitness reports, different eyewitnesses reporting different things. And there's just sort of little bits here, the numbers of the loaves and the fishes and the grass being green and all sorts of things that just have the ring of authenticity. This is not a fable. This is not an allegory. This is not like Debbie's story earlier, which was wonderful, but was made up, as she acknowledged. This is something that actually happened. And we notice the context. Jesus has been teaching these people. We know that from the other Gospels. And they follow him to find out, because they want to know about this person who doesn't just teach, but can heal. Well, he needs a bit of time off, so he goes up into the hill country. I think this is what nowadays is called the Golan Heights, that was so prominent in some of the Arab-Israeli wars in the last century. And he just sits down to be with his disciples. And then John slips this little thing in. The Jewish Passover festival was near. And this was the great moment that they remembered God getting them out of Egypt, the Jewish people at that time. And they've been told to celebrate every year through the ages the rescue that God had performed when they were experiencing the foulness of life in all its rawness in Egypt. And he rescued them. And the Passover was to remember that. And associated with the Passover was the eating of the lamb and of the bread, the feeding of the people with the unleavened bread. And then when they got out into the wilderness, the feeding of the people with the bread from heaven, with the manna. And John just puts that in there, just to say at this point that there's something symbolic going on here, as well as the actual act of feeding. And we'll be seeing that symbolism as we look at the later parts of the chapter after half term. But we come first to just the setting. Jesus having a break. He sat down. He's with his disciples. And he looks up. He looks up. Something made him look up. Maybe the sound of many people coming. Maybe the rush. He looks up and he sees a great crowd coming towards him. And his first reaction is, how are we going to feed these people? They've got to eat. They're hungry. They've been on this sort of all-day seminar. They're hungry, these people. We've got to feed them. So that we can be part of bringing the fullness of Jesus into the foulness of life, the first thing we do is just to enter Jesus' own outlook, to allow Jesus to be within us, if you like, so much that we share this outlook. What does he do? He looks at human need. He does not look away from it. How easy it would have been for him just to look away or say, I'm on a break. Someone else's problem, to ignore it, to keep his eyes looking down, if that's what they were doing. He looks towards human need with eyes of concern and compassion, with eyes of love. It's so basic. It's such obvious Christian teaching. You may say, well, come on, that's sort of Sunday school stuff. It's the sort of stuff you get in churches that don't do real Bible teaching properly, just being told to look out compassionately on the world. Come on, we need a bit more than that. Well, yes, we do need a bit more than that. We don't need any less than that. As we look at the human need of our world, well, we should be looking at it, and looking at it with eyes of love and possibility, because we're allowing Jesus, we're looking at it through the eyes of Jesus, we're looking, allowing the Spirit of Jesus to change our outlook towards it. And so he addresses Philip, who, as we know, is from round there. So he was the obvious person to choose, as he was a local. And he says to Philip, where are we going to buy bread for these people to eat? As far as Philip's concerned, it's obvious to ask him because he's local, but it's also a daft question, isn't it? But then John slips in this word of explanation in verse 6. He asked this only to test him, because he already had in mind what he was going to do. Now, we know that. Because John's told us, John obviously knew, he realized, Jesus had told him perhaps. Philip doesn't know that. We'll come back to verse 6 in a moment. Well, Philip answers him. He's being tested, and he says, well, there's no way we can possibly do this. We haven't got that much money, and it would take half a year's wages to have enough so that everyone could have one bite. Now, the question is preposterous. It's not. It can't be our responsibility. It's impossible for us to do it. Philip answers from within a naturalistic framework in which normal human laws and rules apply. And it's just not possible. As we look out on a world of need, we will have the same response, unless we look out with eyes of faith. The normal human response is to see the needs, to see the great crowds, to see the great masses in all their needs, huge levels of need, and to think it's completely beyond me to do anything about it. I just can't do it. And then to think, well, I'm going to give up. Philip only has natural solutions, and he knows that natural solutions are not enough. He needs to be brought to the point of realizing that actually he can't do anything within his own natural framework. Jesus is testing him so that he's on a kind of learning curve of discipleship. And Jesus will do the same thing to you. Those moments when you feel completely overwhelmed are not moments when God has moved away from you. God is more active in those moments than in perhaps in moments of peace and calm when you think you're experiencing a sense of the presence of God. Well, you may be experiencing a sense of the presence of God there, but actually, in terms of God working in your soul, he is not further away. He is closer and more active in the moments when you feel totally overwhelmed, in the moments when you enter into a sense of darkness or just a sense of difficulty and impossibility. That is Jesus testing you. And the first thing he wants is a response to say, I can't do it. That's okay. That's the right response. We don't want to have that kind of response. We like to think we can do things. We like to think we can fix things. We like to think we can analyze things. We like to think that we have resources to do things. Cambridge is boomtown. Cambridge is an economic, I'm going to say miracle, but an economic boomtown at the moment, intellectual boomtown. Life in Cambridge is one of the best places to live anywhere, people say. There's so much human and other kinds of resource that's going for us in Cambridge. We like to think we're the ones who can do it, and what we do not want to say is actually we can't. We're inadequate. All our ingenuity and know-how and energy and all the rest of it is not enough for what's in front of us. We're being tested. Jesus wants to take every single one of us to that point. And if you haven't been brought to see your own inadequacy, you'll never be able to be the channel for his super adequacy. It's the people who've been brought low and been broken and feel powerless who then can be part of bringing the fullness of Christ into the foulness of this world. Then another disciple speaks up, verse 8. This is Andrew, Simon Peter's brother. And look what he's found. The one person who's got some food with him. Now, I've been trying to anticipate what this might look like. So this is the best that Waitrose could do in kind of representing it. So just give it a moment. I said to the lady behind the counter, can you guess what we're doing in church this morning? And she did. She did guess. I asked her what she thought of the story, and she said she hadn't thought about it for a long time. I couldn't think of the right thing to say. I thought afterwards of all the right things to say. Do you know how that happens to you when you're witnessing? I thought all these really good things that I could have said that would have really helped her, and I thought about them 5 minutes later. So this boy turns up, and he's got, I don't know, were they about this size? They're probably a bit smaller, little bread balls, and then some preserved fish, although his didn't come in a tin. It reminds me a bit of that little jingle, to market, went my brother Jim, where somebody threw a tomato at him. Now, tomatoes are squashy and covered in skin, but this one was different. It came in a tin. You heard that now? It's not really relevant, but I thought that would wake you up. Now, what do we know from this? They were barley loaves. This is where the detail's interesting. Barley was the food of the poor. He was a poor boy. Apparently that persisted in Britain for a while. So Samuel Johnson, the 18th century poet, scholar, diarist, wit, all the rest of it, notoriously said, I'm quoting him, this is not me. He said, barley is something which in England is eaten by cattle and in Scotland is eaten by people. Apologies to anyone, that's him not saying it, not me saying it, but it is representative of an attitude to barley, which is that it was a poor person's feed. And he was just a little boy. But he allowed it to be brought to Jesus. And so Jesus takes it. Now, Andrew is dubious. How far will they go among so many? And again, there's this emphasis on the many, the multitude, the vastness of the need, and the apparent inadequacy of anything that can be offered. And what is this for us? It's whatever we can bring to Jesus to use to serve other people. And to us, if we understand greatly the hugeness of the need and the difficulty of bringing the gospel to people and meeting that need, we will feel that what we have is inadequate. But what Jesus wants is simply for us to bring what we have and surrender it to him and for his use. Notice verse 11, Jesus took the loaves. So the boy brings them and he takes them. Will you allow Jesus to do that with what you have to serve him? It does us so good when we perhaps have a new phase in life. We're able to buy a new flat and just to surrender that to God, to buy a new car and to surrender that to God. Or to think of the abilities that we have that don't seem very much to us, but they are there, and to surrender them, to bring them to Jesus. Now you'll say, how do you do that? It's really, really simple. But it may not be easy. It is simply to pray sincere prayers of the surrender of what we have into Jesus' hands for whatever he can do with them. That's what the little boy did. And that is what he asks us to do. And it seems to me it's not just a one-off thing. It's something we must do again and again and again, particularly when we're faced with a sense that the task is too much for us. There are too many people. The vastness of the crowds compared with the smallness of the lunch, we will all experience something like that, but he still wants us to bring what we have to him and lay it at his feet. And then notice Jesus says, make the people sit down. And the disciples do that, and the people do that. And in our seeking to bring the fullness of Christ into the foulness of this world, there will be times when obedience to Christ seems preposterous. It seems like it could not possibly work, that doing something out of obedience to his law or his leading is never going to produce the results that we want, but he will call us to make those steps of obedience. And if we follow them, he will do what he has planned. Remember again in verse 6, he already had in mind what he was going to do. And it's the same for us. He knows what he's going to do if we will surrender ourselves to him. And then we see the miracle. Jesus then took the loaves and he gave thanks. Let's just stop on that for a moment. It's so beautiful and so wonderful. He gave thanks. How that contrasts with the attitude of self-sufficiency in the modern world. Jack, if we could have the slide up. This is of the Simpson family saying grace before their meal. But one day Bart Simpson, one of the kids, if you don't know it, said grace. And he said this. Dear God, we pay for all this ourselves, so thanks for nothing. And in doing so, he represented a modern world that thinks it's done it all for itself. Okay, you can take it down. I think a backdrop of The Simpsons for too long will probably not be edifying for you. That might be amusing. It's the act of giving thanks before meals and before other things. Putting a sense of gratitude at the heart because everything has come from God. That's wonderful, isn't it? And then what does he do? Well, in a sense, John glosses over the miracle. I mean, he just says he took the loaves, gave thanks, and distributed to those who were seated as much as he wanted. I mean, what was it like? I mean, what, what can it possibly have looked like? It must have been extraordinary. I mean, he must have been going like this, and then it just kept happening. And it went on and on. 5,000 men, and lots of women and children as well. How many people could have been? 20,000 people. If they had nuclear families like we do, and they probably had bigger ones. I mean, it just went on and on and on. And at this point, we really need to nail the fact that a real event, a real miracle is being described. Something supernatural, something completely extraordinary was happening. It wasn't that this is a symbol for everyone suddenly realizing that they needed to bring their lunch out and share it like some kind of great church potluck picnic. This was a totally supernatural miracle. And it's very interesting that there were all these eyewitnesses, 5,000 men and all the women and children as well. John could not have written this and got away with it if it hadn't happened, because the eyewitnesses were checkable. This is a real historical event that really happened, an actual miracle. And it's just lovely, isn't it? He distributed to those who were seated as much as they wanted. I mean, that's the kind of meal you want to go to, isn't it? As much as you want. I mean, they were cramming it in absolutely as much as they wanted. I mean, this is just symbolic of the power and grace and generosity of God. The lavishness that he pours his love down. And then the lovely touch. He did the same with the fish. And then there's all this left over. All these pieces are left over. The 12 baskets full of the loaves left over, as if just to show the lavishness, the totality of what he was doing. There was more than enough, even for a vast crowd. And this miracle stands for so much more than just the feeding of people. It stands for the superabundance of God's grace and God's love of lavishness and plenitude. I mean, we see it just in the natural world, don't we? 340 species of hummingbirds in this world. I mean, we might have created one or two. He made 340. 18,000, I understand, species of butterflies. God loves plurality. 300,000 species of beetle. What kind of God creates that? 100 billion galaxies. And they're saying perhaps there may be 200 billion when we can observe them a bit better. And yet all that abundance in the natural world and the abundance of the feeding just represents for us the supernatural, the miraculous, superabundant power and love of God in the gospel of Jesus Christ. At its heart, the powerlessness of the cross, the amazing power of the resurrection, that message in the power of the Spirit is able to do far more than we can possibly imagine. It is that big. There's more than enough for all the human need in this world. There are leftovers from the gospel, if you like, to be gathered up and then to be shared again. Well, the people are full. And they realize that something symbolic is going on. Verse 14, they see the sign that Jesus performed. And they begin to draw a conclusion, but they draw the wrong conclusion. They say, well, surely this is the prophet. And what they're doing is referring back to a prophecy in the Old Testament, in the book of Deuteronomy, that one day the most amazing prophet would come. They'd know who this guy was, because he would speak the words of God in a very, very special way, unlike anyone else. And they're saying it's him. It's him. But they draw completely the wrong conclusion from it. They want to try to make him into a political movement in which human norms of force and human norms of political government are the means and the ends of what's going on. And Jesus says, that's not who I am. He is the prophet, but he's not the prophet to come and be launched as part of a political movement like that. And so he withdraws and he goes back up the Golan Heights instead. Throughout the church, there have been people who have not wanted to accept Jesus as boss, but has wanted to kind of co-opt him into their own agendas. And sometimes this happens to people individually as well. So we're a Christian and we're doing exams, and we see Jesus as a useful way of getting peace and calm and maybe a little bit of supernatural help. so that we can achieve what we want for ourselves. Or it's the same in work, or it's the same in careers and all sorts of different areas of life, in our health as well. Jesus is a kind of adjunct who we want to co-opt into our agendas and our dreams and our plans. We want, if you like, to make him by force king so that we can have what we want, and that's not why he's come. Instead, the point is to accept him as Lord, to accept him as the one who knows what he is doing, to align ourselves with his agendas and just to receive him and say, okay, you do what you want. Sadly, that's happened sometimes on the grand scale as well, on the whole project of Christendom, of Christian Europe, in which there was the establishment of the church and the rulers together. Certainly from the point of view of the Baptist tradition that we lie in, was in many ways a ghastly, ghastly mistake. It was trying to make Jesus king by force and has had problems that continue to this day. In a kind of related and analogical way, there are many within Islam, some of them terrorists, some of them not, who would want to impose Islam by force. You see it too in India, in terms of the governing party there and the alignment with the Hindu religion. It is often a very, very significant problem when those things go together. Jesus was not to be made king by force. His kingdom is not of this world, but it does come into this world when there are people who don't try and co-opt him to their agendas, but allow themselves to be co-opted into his. So if we're to bring the fullness of Jesus into the foulness of life, we look at human need with him with the eyes of love. We allow Jesus to show us our inadequacy. We give him, we surrender to him whatever we have, we do what he says. And we let Jesus bring his miraculous, superabundant fullness to other people through us. And we accept that it's his agenda, not ours, that matters. What should we do with this? Well, the first thing is just to stand in amazement and awe and realize what a wonderful thing this is. This world in all its foulness is not left to itself, and it's not left to a kind of hope-so optimism, which is the best that the human race can generate for itself. We can fix it, and we haven't been able to fix it, but we keep trying. No, it's more than that. It is the entry of the love of God in Jesus Christ and the fullness of God's blessing in Christ, and that can be for us and be released through us. We're so puzzled about what's going on in our own lives. We're so puzzled about what's going on in the life of the nation and the life of the world. But Jesus knows already what he's going to do. He knows already what he's going to do about militant Islam. He knows already what he's going to do about materialistic, politically correct secularism. He knows already what he is going to do about that thing in your life where it's your human need that's troubling you. He already knows. Isn't that fantastic? And he will act. What is called of us then? Well, just to be like the little boy and the surrender of what we have to him. Someone has said, so often we ourselves have no idea what to do. But the starting point is always to bring what there is to the attention of Jesus. You can never tell what he's going to do with it, though part of Christian faith is the expectation that he will do something we hadn't thought of before, something new and creative. Oh, we say, I'm at my wit's end, and I just can't imagine being used for Christ. I can't imagine getting through these exams and in any way being used for Christ. I've just got to survive. I can't imagine my old age and my disability being used for Christ. I can't imagine the situation at home where the children just occupy me 24/7 being used for Christ. Someone else has said, when we can offer him nothing but weakness, failure, embarrassment and disadvantage, he says, great, I can work with that. And whatever our circumstances, However much we feel that we're just overwhelmed, if we will come to him, if we will surrender to him, there is something he can do to show us more of his fullness and for other people to be able to observe it. Oh, you say, well, this is a long, long way away from the terrorist attacks in Manchester. How does it possibly connect back with that and that particular kind of foulness? Well, one or two suggestions. We support a number of mission partners. A large number of them are working with Muslims. There are all sorts of things that those of us who are supporters can do to enable that work. The church is generous in giving monies. We can contribute to that. We can send little notes of support by email or by WhatsApp messages or whatever. We can pray for them regularly. We'll be doing that, those of us who are here, those of you who are here on Thursday. None of that is wasted. Even quite a short prayer for one of our missionaries each day. I mean, just pray for 10 seconds, perhaps. That may be for you a time offering the equivalent to the loaves and the fishes. Jesus can use that. You've no idea how he might. Now, I'm going to share a story which I've shared once or twice, and you've also heard from someone else, but I've got a little bit to add to it. So if you think you know what's happening, there's a little twist at the end. Lindsay Brown, when he was here a year ago, shared with us a story, which is true, of a British Christian woman who regularly goes to Saudi Arabia. And she visited Saudi Arabia, sometime last year, and saw a friend, a Muslim lady, part of a wealthy Saudi family. And she went to see her. And she hadn't seen her for a bit. And the woman said, oh, lovely to see you. Do come to the house. She came to the house. And the woman invited her to go and see their new basement, which had been built since she'd last been. So they went down the elevator. It was that kind of a house. Opened the door into the basement, and it was all dark. The hostess put the lights on. And there were dozens of people all gathered there. I can't remember right, it may have been 50 or 60, obviously quite a big basement. And the British Christian said, what's all this about? The hostess said, they want you to tell them about Jesus. So without any further explanation, she was just put there and she just had to give an impromptu sermon about Jesus to these 40 or 50 or 60 Saudi people who were all gathered there. So she did that and they asked questions. And then they dispersed. And she turned to the hostess when they were on their own and she said, where did that come from? What has happened? Ah, said the hostess. We have a little Filipina serving girl. A girl from the Philippines who's come to work here, and she's our cleaner, and she does jobs round the house. Okay, said the British woman. So what? Well, said the Saudi woman, I noticed that she kept singing. She sang all day. Every day. And after a bit, I said to her, why do you sing every day? And she said, oh, I'm happy about Jesus. And she went on to explain to her about Jesus and the cross and the resurrection. And the Saudi woman, this upper-class Saudi woman, became a Christian. Now, she had to work out what she was going to do with her husband. She had to be pretty careful, or she could have ended up being divorced or worse. She chose her moment when they were lying in bed, snuggled up late at night, probably a good time, I guess. And she said, darling, something's happened. And she got the chance to witness to him, and he became a Christian. Several other members of their household did. And in their extended clan, others did as well. And it was them and a number of neighbours who'd been invited who were all gathered in that basement. Never think that the way you go about your everyday life, if you can be happy in Jesus, will not make a difference. Now, many of you have heard that story several times, and I apologize if it's getting a bit hackneyed, though, to be honest, I love it every time. But there's a little further twist to it. Because Lindsay told that story, and one woman who heard it was particularly struck. Because sometime before, she'd spent some time praying about the Muslim world and specifically praying for Saudi Arabia and feeling completely powerless to do anything about the center of Islam in Saudi Arabia and just feeling that it was overwhelmingly impossible for her to make any difference. And then she just had a thought. She remembered the story of Naaman the leper. and the little Jewish Israelite slave who'd gone into the house of Naaman the Syrian and had been there and at just the right moment had been able to say that the God of Israel was the true God. And when she heard that, this woman thought, well, I don't think I can do anything for the gospel in Saudi Arabia, but perhaps I could just pray that something like that would happen in modern-day Saudi Arabia. And she was someone who used to wake up quite often in the middle of the night. And so what she would do, she'd wake in the middle of the night and she would specifically pray this prayer when she was suffering from insomnia in the middle of the night. And she would say to God, oh God, will you find a Christian servant in a Saudi family and help them to witness? And when she heard that story, she could not believe it. And she wept tears of joy, because she surrendered all that she had, which was a bit of time in the middle of the night when she had insomnia, to pray a prayer of faith. What will you surrender to him? It's a wonderful old hymn. There's a very good modern version, actually, that Lou Fenningham has done, which we may sing in the next few months. But I'm going to read the old version. Maybe this will be helpful for you where you're at right now. He giveth more grace when the burdens grow greater. He sendeth more strength when the labors increase. To added afflictions he addeth his mercy. To multiplied trials his multiplied peace. When we have exhausted our store of endurance, when our strength has failed ere the day is half done, when we reach the end of our hoarded resources, our Father's full giving is only begun. Fear not that thy need shall exceed his provision. Our God ever yearns his resources to share. Lead hard on the arm everlasting, availing. The Father both thee and thy load will upbear. His love has no limits. His grace has no measure, his power no boundary, known unto men. For out of his infinite riches in Jesus he giveth and giveth and giveth again. Let's be quiet and then I'll pray. We open ourselves, O Lord, to you. We thank you. You know what you want to do in our lives. We give you ourselves, such as we are, in all our inadequacy, our sense of powerlessness. And we don't know, O Lord, what you will do with that, but you do. And we surrender ourselves trustingly and willingly and pray, your will be done. May your fullness come to us and through us and change. Bring change into our world. For your name's sake. Amen.